welcome to the 27th episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. I'm the co-founder of Reckless Dice and your host, Jesse Gitzman-Burke. Co-hosting with me is our lich-like troubadour, Lester Crowe, and his strolling bones.
Hi, Lester.
Hello, Lester. We're also joined by Jordan Bloody Sunboy Steelman.
Yo.
And Layla Fridge Gargoyle Miranova, who has succumbed, like me, to the Black Plague of 2012, which is running rampant through our village. So, excuse the sniffling.
You guys are...
I was actually wondering the same thing.
So you guys aren't dead from the Black Plague? You guys must have a high toughness score.
I mean, really, I think we have all these little snotlings running around the world that are just causing everybody at work, everybody that I know is sick at some point this past week. So I think I'm on the outskirts of it. I think you're on the... You're heading into it.
I'm in the peak of it, I think, right now. Yeah.
It physically hurts to talk.
Yes, it does.
So this doesn't transmit...
Look at the sacrifice.
This doesn't transmit via wireless internet connection, does it?
I mean, I don't know. Can you Canadians contract what we Americans have anyway?
I hope not. It's pretty cold up here, so maybe maybe the cold kills it.
So let's start off with a little roundtable of what we've been up to over the last 2 weeks. Has anybody had a chance to get any good gaming in? Lester, you want to kick us off?
I have not done any gaming. There's actually been kind of, I wouldn't say a tragedy, but a pretty intense experience that I don't want to go into full details about due to legal ramifications. So I've kind of been busy with out-of-gaming things. But I've been using my word processor quite effectively.
Did you do that on purpose? Oh, say bin normally.
I totally did that on purpose. but I've been using that to write up some stuff. I'm trying to get my gaming group back together once we manage to figure out this legal mumbo-jumbo. What about you guys?
Layla and I have had a chance to kick off one of my favorite adventures from 2nd edition, Lure of the Lich Lord. So we played that on, was it Tuesday of last week or Wednesday? And we'll be putting that up on the web, I think, this weekend. So we got through the first, I'd say about a quarter of the adventure would be my guess, but it's kind of hard to tell. For those of you familiar with it's kind of a traditional dungeon crawl from 2nd edition, so we're kind of on the fly converting it into 3rd edition and coming up with a creative way of inserting that into our existing gaming group. So I hope you guys enjoy that one. But that's been good fun. And we've also been planning an interview for Fantasy Flight, who has offered us to do a written interview where we can pose some questions to them. So I've been composing a list of what I'd like to learn from them over kind of how what they're doing with the game, what they have planned, and you know how Heroes Call fits into kind of the greater scheme of things.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That'll be kind of neat to hear them step in, and
I hope they'll be as open as I want them to be. And I'm kind of designing it with a variety of different, like, difficulty levels of questions, you know, with, like, some of them are, like, real basic, like, hey, just give us an answer, and some of them are more like, you know, hey, can you... I'm trying to format them in a way that'll encourage them to really just have an open discussion on what's going on without really committing themselves to everything.
Yeah, spoiling too much?
Yeah, because I don't want to put them in a position where they just won't answer. I want them to be able to give us something, but won't really spill all the beans, because I know they won't want to. So I'm trying to put some good thought into it. So if anybody has any questions they want to ask, or things like that are really, you know, well thought out questions that we really want to hear that could drive some discussion, I'm very open to including them in my roster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely don't want to discourage them. I mean, I think it'd be good for them to actually get involved in the community, because it has been growing quite a bit lately. There's been a lot of community involvement on Facebook and on the website.
Yeah, Facebook's still exploding. That's we're having a great time there.
Yeah, for sure.
I think everybody moved from the actual website comments to Facebook, because the website comments have gone down substantially, but the we're still seeing increase in traffic there, mm-hmm. but the Facebook traffic has pretty much just taken off with multiple discussions going each day.
I just think it's a lot easier for people to access that. So,
yeah, I think so too. And Jordan, what have you been up to?
I did have one session, not this past weekend, but 2 weekends before that. So we continued to delve into Shadows Over Bogenhofen. I tried a new thing this past session after, you know, we were having all the conversations about Paizo's cards and all that, the item mm-hmm. cards. I didn't actually pick up the item cards, but I picked up several of the PC portrait cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, watch.
Oh, yeah. Michael Wilson, our other live sessions that we put up, uses a lot of those.
You know what? And I was actually, I was listening to the first part of Buried But Not Forgotten, and mm-hmm. he was describing, you know, showing the picture of an NPC, and he was describing what the NPC looked like, and I think I knew exactly what card he was talking about. So I'm like, oh, I bet he's using those cards too.
He has a lot of those, supplements and additions. He has a lot of nice visual aids to experience.
Yeah, I think that's, for me at least, that's a really important thing. It's actually not something new to me. I used to, and I still do, but I haven't done it in a while, but one of my big role-playing games was the old West End games, Star Wars, and a lot of the adventure supplements and box sets and everything, they came with the NPCs on little kind of perforated cards that had the character artwork on them. So that's an idea that I've used for years and years and years. And when I was preparing to run Shadows Over Bogenhofen, and I realized that how many different NPCs the players were going to be running into over the course of the adventure. And I was like, how are the players going to keep all this straight? I mean, there's literally like 30 or 40 NPCs that they're going to be interacting with, and I wanted to give them something to hold on to when they run into, you know, the captain of the town watch, then I can kind of give them an idea of what this guy, kind of how he presents himself, and then they can remember this guy, so the next time they see him, they'll know who that is, you know, they'll call him out by name or whatever. It's worked really well so far.
You know, one thing that Michael does, which I find really useful, is on those cards, he uses a little bit of markable tape and writes out their name on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we see somebody, you know, that has their name written out, because I find in many, many games, you're saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to go back to that noble's house, uh-huh. that guy. And, you know, you kind of, if you don't say the name a dozen times or see it or write a note down for yourself, it's very easy to forget.
That's why it's always nice to have a note taker at the table, somebody who pays a lot of attention to the storyline and writes the notes down. That's really good.
But that's definitely hit or miss whether you actually get one of those people or not. So
fair enough.
Well, we've all been waiting for Fantasy Flight to put out the press release that we all knew was coming prior to the release of Heroes Call, where they were going to outline the two new races and confirm what they are. So we now have some new news. They are, as we already know, the Halflings and the Ogres. And with a nice little one-page overview, they put out a press release very similar to the ones they've done in the past. They even had a few tidbits of new information in there, but do you guys want to give us a quick overview of what they gave us in the press release entitled The Odd Couple?
They put a couple really cool pictures in here. Like, there's a picture of the Iron Gut, I believe that's his name, or the Ogre Man-Eater. That's a really, really well done piece of artwork with all the heads hanging from his belt.
I'm looking at that right now. I didn't even notice those.
And then
there's an elf and a couple dudes.
He's that huge? I totally thought those were like illustrations or something on him.
No, they're massive. Ogres are really, really big.
Yeah. The scale of that looks a little bit off. That almost looks like a giant, but I mean, you know, I know ogres are big, but I don't know.
I don't know. You're kind of right. I mean, ogres were supposed to, they're supposed to be, what, like 8 feet tall or something, but still.
I mean, either way, the artwork's fantastic. Yeah. You see he's using shields and stuff as arm plates, and he's got that huge two-handed sword that's just absurdly large. And I love that he's dressed in the in fine Empire clothing, except only on parts of him because it barely fits.
Yeah, he's got the gut plate that's kind of like it's like a Sigmar's Comet kind of thing. Yeah.
Almost like he's torn it off of some, like, church somewhere and, like, thrown it on his belly.
Or it's like a shield or something.
Yeah, they spoiled what the gut plate does, too. I mean, it has, like, a defense rating of 2, a soak value of 1, and 4 encumbrance, and it tells basically what it does. And they also spoil what the halfling chef's career ability is as well.
The gut plate, I thought, was really interesting because it allowed... The gut plate is, for those of you kind of unfamiliar with ogres, we had some requests to kind of delve a little into more of how they work. We actually did a whole episode centering on ogres not too long ago, I think 5 or 6 episodes back. But ogres are really big in protecting their belly. Their belly has this huge, thick hide around it, and a lot of their organs and stuff are hidden behind that, you know, flap of skin. So they almost exclusively armor their belly with this thing called a gut plate. And the item for gut plate I thought was interesting because, like you said, Lester, it has defense and soak values, but it's in addition to any other armor you'd normally be wearing. Mm-hmm. So in theory, an ogre could have his gut plate, his armor, and carry a shield. You could actually start stacking a ton of stuff. An ogre could be a tremendous
I wonder how they're
offensive or defensive character.
Well, how are they going to, like, shore up the differences in cost? Like, an ogre buying plate armor is going to be way more expensive than a halfling buying plate armor. So I wonder how
that's
they're
interesting.
Address that.
That's not mentioned in this summary here. I wonder. There is still a lot of things that we'll discover as the actual content comes out and available to us to read in detail. I'm hoping things like that will become a little clearer because, you know, the sheer amount of metal, like you said, is going to be very different.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm honestly anticipating them doing an items kind of thing because that's kind of goes with the way they developed second edition and stuff. And I am kind of anticipating them doing kind of a mercantile or items kind of supplement in the future.
You know, one thing with the ogre they also mentioned is that all ogres have to start as an ogre man-eater.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can go into different careers from there, but every ogre begins as a man-eater career.
All right.
And didn't we hear from in the actual unboxing episode that I think they can only take the careers that are both applicable to human and dwarf?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was what I was hearing.
Yeah,
so you're saying we can't have an ogre witch hunter
or wizard
or an ogre rat catcher.
Yeah, he has to be. It has to be like a coachman or I don't know. I can't
or
remember all of them.
Or
yeah,
or something.
You know, one thing they did here, which I thought was fun, that we haven't seen in the past. Maybe it wasn't appropriate in the past either, but they gave us. Is it 6 or so?
Yeah, there's 6
sample characters. With backgrounds and everything all filled in for 3 for the halflings, I think it's 3 for the ogres, where they give you an example of what that character could be and ways to really kickstart integrating these either NPCs or PCs into your games. Because I don't know how you guys felt, but I was having a hard time really envisioning how to effectively implement ogres specifically into the world. Halflings, you know, okay, you got a cook or something. That's not too hard. But the ogres, I still struggle with a bit.
Mm-hmm. They're tricky because there's certainly a lot of adventures, and actually, I would dare say, a lot of published adventures that ogres would pretty well ruin just because, or at least they couldn't participate fully in, you know, anything involving diplomacy or, you know. If you have to approach a noble and you know, take him to dinner or something like that.
I mean, can you guys? I think it was on Facebook. Somebody posted the picture of the female ogre model from Games Workshop with the fake beard and like giant ogre boobs and everything. It was.
Is Shrek an ogre?
Yes, Shrek is an ogre, but not a Warhammer ogre.
Right, no, I realize that. For some reason, though, and I don't know why I'm making this association now, but, I mean, I just kind of accepted that ogres were totally cool and would fit in just about anywhere, and I largely think that's because of the Shrek movie. I'm now realizing.
Well, I mean, I picture them a little more mindless than Shrek. I mean, they may still be a little goofy, but that's because they think with their belly, and they like money and gold.
They're like onions.
They're layered and like a parfait. We won't do Shrek quotes. But I kind of feel like they can be some great comic relief, like dwarves can as well. They have some very ingrained personalities that can be very interesting. They probably get into fights. They like to eat just about everything, you know, even if it's inedible.
Yeah,
I totally want to be an ogre.
They eat all the time.
I think you could probably make a great character out of that model from Games Workshop, where you are a female ogre pretending to be a man who's trying to assimilate herself into Imperial culture. That would be brilliant.
I personally don't think that it would be any weirder having an ogre in a party than, like, a troll slayer or something like that. I think they're both kind of foreign to the center of the Empire and stuff like that. They're all
kind
of
strange. You mean,
like,
from that, like, cultural acceptance perspective?
Yeah, I don't think it's that strange. I mean... Yeah. Just because I've always known ogres to be, it like in the story of the of Warhammer, the setting, I've always known them to be part of the Empire.
And so let's throw out a couple examples here. Where would we see an ogre? Let's do this both for halflings and the ogres. Where is an acceptable place to kind of find an ogre or be an ogre?
At a bar. A mercenary town.
Maybe a noble's bodyguard.
Yeah. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
part of the army or militia.
Or maybe
he might be like the brute force guy.
Yeah, maybe even working in like a quarry or something like that.
Yeah, like heavy manual labor.
Yeah, he could have been captured or whatever. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, lifting crates and stuff.
I don't know how well they would be on ships, though. I don't know if they would actually be on a ship. But at the dock, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, being stevedores and that sort of thing. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Bodyguards.
Yeah, definitely. Yep. Yeah, like a merchant bodyguard, sure.
Uh-huh.
So do you guys picture ogres in any places of intelligence or leadership?
I'd have to really look at all the different careers that they would be able to go into to see if it's even feasible mechanically. But
I think like my first gut feeling is no, they're probably not going to be.
Well, it's a social acceptance thing. I mean, the nobility of the Empire to take an ogre noble seriously, I don't think that would really happen.
And I mean, I don't foresee anybody who wants to play an ogre character really caring about social actions at all. Maybe if burp was a social action.
I'm going to wonder if there's some social actions for them, like eating something inappropriate or, you know, to solve an issue, you've eaten it.
Yeah. Break wind.
Yeah. I'm picturing a lot of bodily function role-playing happening here.
Yeah.
I think that would make for some comedy.
Oh, yeah.
I guess I see the ogre as mostly just, like, comic relief. Does anybody who would play an ogre think that they would take themselves seriously? Because I wouldn't.
I mean, no, it's for the person who doesn't want to socialize and just wants to beat on things, or somebody who wants to beat on things and have a fun time, I think.
Uh-huh.
I could see somebody being a serious ogre, though, who wants to be, like, a really violent, serious ogre. But, I mean, once again, it's really niche, somebody wanting to pick an ogre, just like someone wanting to be a high elf, though.
Well, I gotta find a way now to, like, incorporate an ogre into a game, because I don't think I've ever had one in any of my games. So I think there'll be a lot of that going around.
Should get
soon.
Blorg. Blorg should be in there. He's one of the guys. Blorg. He's one of the guys they detail here in the set.
The ogre man-eater known only as Blorg.
Yeah.
Like Madonna and Cher before him.
Yeah, he found his way to the Empire largely due to his fondness for the taste of orcs. So they like to eat orcs, apparently. Well, Blorg does.
So halflings. Let's talk a little bit about where are we going to find halflings in the world.
In the kitchen.
I was going to say that.
They are known for their familiarity with food. Where else? They have a propensity to be known as thieves or pickpockets and things like that. In local gangs,
mm-hmm.
Very appropriate gambling.
Mm-hmm.
Breweries, inns.
They strike me as being apt to qualify for a lot of manual labor, not physically intensive, but like messengers and scribes and that sort of thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Maybe farm hands or something like that.
Yeah.
So the halfling chef career card is given here, where once per day you may make a special meal and roll a white die equal to your fellowship score, and anyone eating the meal recovers a number of stress and fatigue equal to the number of successes rolled. So that's another good one.
That's kind of interesting, but I think the stress and fatigue is just so easily recovered with other abilities, mm-hmm. like, you know, assess the situation, or when there's a rally step, you recover it equal to your, you know. So, I mean, that would be really good if you're being overly attacked with stress and fatigue.
I'm just picturing the halfling in the middle of combat breaking out the pot of stew and like quickly handing out like cups to everybody.
That would be like a several round action if I were the GM. I wouldn't let them just start making a meal in the middle of nowhere.
They're like caddies.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's kind of how I envision them.
Would you like a 9-iron, sir?
Yeah, totally. Mince meat?
So the last bit on this this press release here, they did one really cool piece of artwork, which has several little teasers in it to what we can probably see in the Ultimate Adventure, or at least the Heroes box. The picture... Do you guys recognize what that's a picture of?
A Hell Pit Abomination? Is that what we're talking about?
That's right. Yeah, that's the Skaven Hell Pit Abomination, which is from the Clan Mulder, mm-hmm. which are very famous for stitching together creatures and trying to bring them, reanimate them back to life through using warp stone and chaos energies. Mm-hmm. So I do recall hearing that the Hell Pit Abomination would be one of the epic monster cards.
Sweet.
So that'll be in there. And then this picture also has what looks like a PC, probably a PC rat catcher.
Yeah, it is definitely a rat catcher.
Climbing up the hind side of the creature with her knives.
I believe it's Rosie Duckend.
Oh, you think it is Rosie? It probably is. It's right under her profile.
Pretty sure, yeah.
Oh, Rosie may need a bigger dog to help her face the epic monsters in Heroes Call.
Yeah.
And so she's climbing up the hindquarters of this hell pit abomination, and at her feet is her small but vicious dog clinging to her ankles as she climbs her way up the creature.
Yeah, her unnamed small but vicious dog, because she feels that it's bad luck to name her pets.
But she will name her downsized rat pole
Bacon. Is Bacon. That, yeah. I love how they say how she hasn't tried cooking rat for herself, but she sells it to other halfling chefs who sell it to the nobles as delicacies.
So those of you guys who kind of dovetail on one of our earlier episodes where we were talking about doing character creation and backstories. There's six examples here of very brief and very effective backstories for characters.
Well, like two paragraphs.
I think these are great templates on something that you can get some inspiration from, because some of these things are very minor and simple, yet are extremely effective when actually playing the game. Mm-hmm. Things like she's named her rat pole, and she won't name her dog. You know, those are brilliant.
Yeah, or Lorg likes to eat orcs. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's kick it back over to the main agenda here. As you may recall from last episode, Marcus Anderson helped us unbox Heroes Call and answer a whole bunch of questions of ours. And in the last 2 weeks, we've had a whole bunch more questions come through, and also we've re-engaged Marcus to help us answer a lot of those. And he's had a chance to go through the content in a little bit more detail, and we've got a couple other pieces that we can talk about that will... help clarify some of the new stuff that's coming in the supplement. Additionally, the Buried But Not Forgotten episodes 1 and 2 are live, like we said. This weekend we're going to be recording the next two episodes, so look forward to those in the coming weeks. Now, Lester, we've been talking about doing this thing on Map Tools for a while, where we kind of get the community together and give everybody a chance to play some online. Mm-hmm. Talk to give some live examples of things. I'm thinking what we might want to do in the coming weeks is do something that we did early on when we launched the podcast, was you and I log on to Map Tools and host an afternoon game session. Yeah. Where anybody is, we'll give out the username and password to join us, and anybody who feels like it can join in, and we'll just kind of do an impromptu game. Do some introductory sessions and just kind of chat with anybody who feels like joining us.
Yeah, I'd really like to revisit that. I had a lot of fun when we were playing on those map tools. Plus, I'd love to actually utilize those maps that you spent all that time making, because we played...
What's the one? You and I were both working on the Edge of Night one. That was fun.
Yeah, man, that was really fun. And we could even show people who are interested in maybe being game masters. I liked how you walked me through and showed me the basic, rudimentary skills required, and it was cool. Pretty interesting.
Well, I'm thinking tentatively we'll schedule that for two weekends from now. So we'll make updates on the Facebook page for anybody who's interested. So please check there. We'll have login information and dates and times.
For sure. Sounds awesome.
Now, somebody sent us a nice comment with an interesting idea that I wanted to run by the three of you, and kind of see your thoughts on how we might be able to implement this effectively. And the request was that fans could send in, you know, a couple minute MP3s or audio files of either a live play session or an excerpt from their games where we would be able to, you know, either critique it, discuss it, or elaborate on the concepts that they're talking about, but basically allow the listeners to incorporate some of their content into the show and make it something that we can kind of feed off of.
Mm-hmm. I think that'd be awesome. You do even like a mashup of a whole bunch of different MP3 files or whatever.
Well, I think what, the part that kind of spurred this on was that people were really enjoying the different GM styles that were being presented through the live play sessions. So this would allow even an even broader spectrum, and for us to react to some of the way other people play, because we have we have our groups, which, you know, we get a fair amount of GMs, so we have like four or so GM perspectives that we can kind of analyze, but this would allow us to talk a little bit even broader than that, and maybe talk about the benefits and detriments of different people playing.
As long as we don't get like 20-minute clips with really bad audio and like 50,000 inside jokes that nobody else understands, I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, but I think we can always just filter that though, right? I mean, send...
Well, yeah, but we'll have to listen to it to filter it. I would like somebody to filter it before we listen to it.
I was going
to
say there's four of us, so I mean, I could listen to... I mean, as long as it's obviously not an hour long or half an hour long. I mean, obviously, but
I mean, some degree of audio editing we can handle here. Yeah. But at the same point, I think I'm there as well. Where you know, if we are more than well excited to accept some of that content and use it on the show. If anybody feels like recording some of your stuff, please do. If you're able just to send it via email to recklessdice@gmail.com, that is perfectly fine. If for some reason the file size exceeds what's available there, just shoot us an email saying you'd like to send one, and we'll work out a way for you to get it to us, you know, Dropbox or something like that. So, you know, I think we're just going to kind of leave it at that for now. We're open to it. If anybody has something, send it, and we'll kind of let it mature from there a little organically.
Well, the community is key, right? That's why we keep doing this. And the more community input we have, the better the show's going to be. So I think it's a great idea.
Cool. And so what we'll also the other last part there that was mentioned was that there was a request for us to kind of do maybe some impromptu role playing live on the show, where we illustrate a mechanic or a technique that is that we're trying to, you know, illustrate. So instead of just reading the rules, maybe we almost all hop into character right on the spot and come up with a way to actually like play 2 or 3 minutes of live game while we do it.
I thought that could be really fun.
I'm all for this idea.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that could encourage us to... It shows us we would have to make a character on the spot, mm-hmm. and we have to just hop right in.
We could even do, like, a tutorial on how to create a character while we make our own.
I think that'd be fun. We did the character creation episode. Lester, that was you and I who did that one, right?
We did a couple, because we did one when Paul was still with us.
Mm-hmm. Then we did, like, the 2.0, which was much more in-depth, and I think that was where you and I made our characters... For the one we did with Ian Robinson,
and that was fun. I like that.
I don't know if we got into too much backstory on that one.
No, I just liked your dwarf. He was funny.
Snorri Gundriksen.
Yeah, he was pretty awesome.
with his classic scope on his blunderbuss.
Yeah, and I learned not to play an Italian character because my Italian accent is subpar at best.
All right, so we're gonna the last bit here is. I think I've decided that we will begin to maintain a roster of people looking to play online with each other as a just community resource. So if anybody is looking to play online via Map Tools or Fantasy Grounds or really something, we'll try and work on maintaining some kind of database that we can share. I don't know the details of how I want to do this yet, but if you want to participate in online games and want to get connected with other people who want to do that, we get enough requests that it's probably worth doing now. So just assume if you give me your contact information, I will certainly keep it confidential and will only share it with other people who ask to play online games. So share with me what you want to share, email, Skype ID, or something like that. We'll work it out from as the idea matures. So when we get back from the break, We are going to talk about the new information that we've recovered from Heroes Call with some of your questions and answers from Marcus Anderson. And following that, we are going to talk about a kind of a side topic of what we've been considering from Heroes Call, which is what to do with these experienced players that have been around for a while. Not the actual people, but the PCs that you've been playing. What do you do when your character gets to high level? How do you keep them motivated? What do you do when they die? So we'll be back in a moment. And we're back. So we have a chance now to talk a little bit more about the Heroes Call box. We've learned a little bit over the last 2 weeks in addition to what we had when we unboxed it with Marcus Anderson. So, Layla, why don't you kick us off with some of the questions from Facebook, the boards, and the Reckless Dice page.
Sure. Some of these have names attached to them. Some of these don't. But can you elaborate slightly on that rank 5 Shalion blessing, please?
So the one he's talking about here, this is the one where the PCs are allowed to purchase an action card that is, once you've used it, it's gone, and you need to reacquire it through spending experience points. And this one is, it's not a all classes can use a card like we maybe once thought. This is specific to a rank 5 Shalion blessing, and without getting into too much detail on both sides of the card, what we've learned is it pretty much heals everything. Now, I don't know if that means cures corruption. I don't know if that means it cures wounds and critical wounds and ailments and insanities. That may be a little vague still, but the gist of it is that it's a mega heal.
Sweet.
I don't even know if it's for the whole party or to one person.
Hmm. Can you describe the contents of the map without spoiling the adventure?
Who's going to take this one? We should plan this out a little better.
Jordan, take it.
So the map is for, how do you pronounce that? All these crazy German names here.
The
Tufeltal. Tufeltal.
Yeah.
Which can be translated as Devil's Valley. It's located in the Grey Lady Pass, which is just west of the Ubersreich. So it kind of continues the theme that they've, third edition has been going on, which is to kind of center a lot of the activities around that Ubersreich region. Yeah,
the lower Reichland.
Yeah. So this is the pass that connects the Grey Mountains, which is the border between Bretonnia and the Empire.
Mm-hmm.
This is also very close to where like Castle Drachenfels is.
Mm-hmm.
This is right near Hugeldal, which is the focus of the Nurgle adventure. So I have to naturally assume that the adventure is associated with the map. So that means that we might even have some Bretonnia involved in some level here, maybe?
Possibly, yeah.
I kind of wonder.
It's orcs, right? That's what we are assuming. I mean, as far as I can tell, it's an orc adventure.
My understanding is it is an orc adventure. And, you know, the orcs, of course, are up in the hills as well.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of wonder, you're so close to Bretonnia. Just give us that little tickle of something. You know, I wonder if it'll be there or not.
Possibly. There might be a character or two. But I don't know if they're really going to bring in, like, a lot of Bretonnia. Maybe a dash.
I'm hoping for that dash.
Yeah, fair enough.
Can you provide any feedback on how the box set prepares the third edition for the Storm of Chaos campaign?
It says here that it provides lots of things that would be needed for a long campaign with heroic focus. It provides some of the enemies needed, as well as giving players and player characters high level and epic options for their characters. The box set also talks about how to handle famous PCs, so people like Luther Huss and probably Karl Franz.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that Valten character from the Storm of Chaos.
Well, actually, it's saying famous PCs, so not famous NPCs.
Oh,
so
yeah.
This actually may have some rules for when your guy is walking down the street, everybody can just be like, oh my god, can you believe who's here?
Throwing coins at him and like flowers. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I was assuming, you know, peasant dresses would be flying off, but I'm not sure if there's rules
rats
for that.
Getting pelted with rats, famous rat catcher.
Yeah.
to me, it just feels natural that the Storm of Chaos campaign will be released. That's, I think we can all agree with that. And after the 4 Chaos God supplements, the last piece should be some sort of campaign, because the whole story of the Storm of Chaos is that Archaon, the Everchosen, you know, gathers these different artifacts together, and he like curries favor from all 4 of the Chaos Gods and gains their
typically
powers.
Typically, all warring against each other, yeah. In addition to warring against humanity.
Yeah, and then
he kind of gets them all on the same page.
And it's dangerous when, you know, Chaos unites, Chaos Undivided, they call that. So, I mean, I think that that's the natural flow of how they've been releasing stuff. It's only natural.
Are there rank 4 and 5 Chaos Cult spells?
So Marcus let us know that there were not any other rank 4 or 5 spells for any of the bad guy esque stuff like dark magic and Skaven magic and Wog magic and any of the chaos magic, but he does let us know that there are some epic attack and support cards for the bad guys. So for the dark elves, for the green skins, for chaos, things like that.
I think we can foresee that coming, though, if they do, as we're assuming, release this Storm of Chaos campaign.
Do you really feel, though, that like the bad guys need rank 4 and 5 spells? Because a lot of their characters themselves, like a greater demon, has some built-in abilities and special effects almost make up for that.
But
I don't know if they need it.
I already have a feeling, because this game can be deadly, but I still feel that it's not quite as deadly as older versions of the game. Mm-hmm. And I think that it takes a game master kind of tinkering with it a little bit to actually make it difficult on the PCs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's room for, especially if we're talking about, you know, which I guess we'll get to later on in the show too. But talking about how to threaten these epic level mm-hmm. PCs, and they're, you know, the third edition PCs can already, if they're focusing in the right direction, they can already be pretty potent. And
yeah.
So there, I could see the desire for more bigger, badder stuff for the bad guys, so that they can lay the smack down.
Especially magic, because, I mean, chaos magic seems mm-hmm. so sweet, especially if it had, like, if it was a double-edged sword, where it was super powerful, but it could also, you know, really mess up the person wielding it.
Right. Like wah magic.
Yeah.
Do we have any examples for new special rules for the different regions of the Empire?
Well, I've got some information on 3, well, it's 2 of the regional humans, and then the Barak-Var dwarves as well. But it says here the Ostermarkers gain fortune dice against fear and terror tests and extra defense when they're outnumbered.
That's really cool flavor.
Yeah.
So from Ostermark, is that where? That's why? Those are the guys near Sylvania, right?
That's
which is the land kind of.
Ostermark is bordering Kislev, so they would be like the first ones to take the brunt of chaos when chaos invades.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, interesting. So
it would be defenders. Yeah, Stirland is the one that's actually where Sylvania is in mm-hmm. Stirland.
And then it says Averlanders, who are, you know, the breadbasket of the Empire, they recover stress and fatigue while killing greenskins, which that's kind of an interesting
And Averland is the southernmost
Rolling,
correct?
Rolling plains. And
So they're the ones that incorporate the Blackfire Pass.
Yeah, exactly.
So this greenskin killing bonus is very appropriate for their storyline, because they bear the brunt of most of the greenskin invasions mm-hmm. through the Blackfire Pass to keep the Empire safe.
Uh-huh. And they are renowned horsemen as well.
Yeah.
And so it says here that they also, if they acquire a horse, their horse gets +1 strength.
That's really sweet.
Because they know how to pick a good horse.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And then the Barak-Var dwarves, it says they get to train their choice of charm, discipline, or resilience at character creation instead of the, you know, whatever the normal weapon skill and resilience and the other one that Karak Azgrad's dwarves get.
See, that's personally my favorite part. Like, the thing I'm most interested in this supplement is how they did that. They divided the regions up and gave the different regions special abilities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a question that I think I forgot to add in here that I'm just going to insert right now, because it takes off of that question nicely. Someone was asking, when generating your characters randomly, how does all these new regions kind of get incorporated into that? So if, you know, like normally a you know, Reichlanders are the most common. This is kind of roughly how it's written in the book, but Reichlanders are the most common, dwarves are uncommon, and elves are rare. But so how do you determine all the other regions as well? Do you just roll the Reichlanders and then re-randomize it if you determine you're
a
human?
Roll a 10-sided dice.
I think essentially that randomly generated character system is going to get largely, I don't want to say broken, but it doesn't work anymore if you're wanting to include all of these. And I have a feeling it's probably not going to be addressed in the book. I hope I'm proven wrong, but I wouldn't count on it.
I'd just roll a 10-sided dice if you became a human. And then how many different dwarf ones were there? Were there six now? Or are there less?
I think it was four.
There's four. Just roll a 4-sided dice then.
So I think what I would suggest doing is first, you know, randomize what race you're going to be, and then randomize amongst the available cultures within that race.
Totally.
I don't think you'll be able to use the existing mechanics. I think, like Lester said, you break it down into a 10-sided die roll or something like that.
All right. Moises Para commented on the Reckless Dice podcast status update. There's only one question I guess everybody is having. When the F are they going to release Heroes Call? I think that Fantasy Flight Games should have more consideration and communication with their fans. That's not really a question, but...
That is a statement.
That begs some discussion, though, yeah.
That's a when the F statement. Well,
there was a when the F, yeah.
If you live in Sweden, apparently you can get your hands on it, so...
Bleeps and bloops.
Move to Sweden if you want Heroes Call.
I think our guess here at Reckless Dice has been, once we saw this press release that came out today... Our guess is 2 weeks from then. So I think we're looking at the beginning of March as a realistic release date.
Yeah, the status on the website shows it's still in shipping status, but you know that could change at any moment. It could go into or rather it's on the boat, and then that could go into distribution at any time. So but once it hits distribution, then
it's already there then at that point.
It's already on the boat to Sweden.
I've heard a lot of people say not to really hang on the release dates of like Amazon or the on the boat status, because generally what I've heard is when it's on the boat, it just goes from on the boat to it's in the stores.
Yeah.
Even though there is that piece in between, more often than not, it doesn't get updated until a little bit later. So
it's totally understandable, though. I mean, Fantasy Flight Games, I think one thing that everybody needs to realize is it's a huge company that has so many different games going on.
They only make Warhammer, and they only make it for them to get on board with this.
There's only so many people who are dealing with this and dealing with, you know, communicating with the fans. I do agree. I think they should have a better presence on the forums, and I think they should consider us more, considering we've been doing this for like a year and a half. You know, I'm glad they're giving us the opportunity to, you know, send an interview with them, but. I mean,
they did give us in my communication with their marketing department. They did give us a nice thank you for working on the show, and that they appreciate it. So that was nice.
And it is growing. Like, I think more and more people are putting stuff up on YouTube. Like Jordan,
and I now have a direct line to somebody at the company who will woe the day he gave it to me.
Yeah. Well, I used to pester Jay Little when, like, I got Jay Little's information when I was first trying to get into doing the freelance work for them, and I used to pester him all the time. He was actually pretty good for replying to me, considering how busy.
So, if anybody wants to send questions directly to somebody, his email is
no. Let's not do that. We don't want to shoot ourselves in the foot before we actually get an interview. All right. Should we move on here?
Yeah.
We've got another tidbit for you as well. Fantasy Flight Games is introducing something that they're calling Extended Challenges, which is kind of cool system. The players get the difficulty of the task from the GM, and then they have to roleplay and do things to get the positive dice to meet that challenge. And in the end, you roll the pool to see the result. It's best illustrated by an example, and the example in the book is a witch trial where the PCs gather evidence to prove that the accused is innocent. They get a base difficulty of 3 challenge dice, and then it's up to the PCs to find clever ways to prove that the accused is innocent, which adds positive dice to the pool. Finding a reliable, trusted witness could provide a conservative die, for example, making up an alibi could add a reckless die. So instead of creating a pool from one player's characteristics and skills, the players roleplay and do mini-adventures to add positive dice to the pool. We haven't tried it out yet, but it seems very fun and a smart way to use the dice in a different manner.
That's really interesting. You know, and it's kind of funny that Fantasy Flight seems to kind of continue to surprise us with new ideas every now and again with this game.
This is definitely one that surprised me. When I read it, I was like, what in the world are they doing? Not another mechanic, but by the time I finished that paragraph, I was like, that's a fun idea.
Yeah, well, and you know what it kind of sounds like is their own backwards approach to creating kind of, you know, what D&D 4th edition went into with skill challenges, but where they seem to be kind of playing it from the other angle where 4th edition said, well, you know, tell me what skill you're using and then tell me how you're using that skill. Here it's almost like saying, well, tell me what you're trying to do, and then based on what you do, that will tell you what dice you're going to roll.
Yeah, exactly.
It feels like you're generating a dice pool mm-hmm. for what would otherwise be a grand act.
Exactly.
And instead of role-playing out the entire trial, your entire group builds a dice pool
yeah.
over the course of the adventure, which ultimately you'll roll and discover the major results at the end of, like, the trial.
Yeah.
It's great. It almost feels like that you can use this mechanic to replace the tracking token mechanic in a lot
yeah.
of ways.
Yeah. You know what?
Because I find that system cumbersome. But
well,
this system is very simple and elegant, I think. I like this.
I think what I would do is I would just give, like, I really do like this, but I would make a track, and I would track how many times it would go around the table for the PCs to come up with clever ways to, mm-hmm. you know, add positive dice. And once it's done...
Well, I don't think it's something where you sit and say, okay, everybody start coming up with ideas. I think it's something where, like, you know, okay, we're playing, and over the course of our session, you guys uncovered a credible witness that you could use. I will then, in my GM screen, you know, add that conservative die, and then you guys are like, you know, on the fly, okay, we're going to come up with an alibi too. That'll probably work, but we need more evidence. Let's go out and search for more evidence. And you guys, like, role play out that and play it for a while, and a half hour later, it's like, okay, cool, now you guys have a blue die because you have some credible evidence.
Uh-huh.
And you just kind of, like, you keep, it might take you an hour or three, or even, like, a multi-part adventure to accumulate the pool and execute it, but that could be, I think, a very fun way, because what happens then when you roll that, you know, forget the success or failure. That part kind of makes sense.
Well, you can't forget that, because if you forget it, then they execute.
Well, I mean, I mean forget it for the point of discussion, because it you know, that's pretty self-explanatory how that works. But what happens when you roll some of the funky stuff, like delays, chaos stars, critical successes on a roll of that magnitude? Some
well,
really cool stuff could happen.
I think if you roll a delay, you could be known in the town as a stutterer, and that could, you know, hurt your chances with, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, what happens on a chaos star roll on a witch's trial? That could be fantastic.
Yeah, maybe the witch's gun goes off accidentally and shoots himself in the foot or something. Or the witch hunter's gun goes off and shoots himself in the foot or something like that.
Accidentally shoots the judge.
Yeah, or you could just have something simple like the shutters blow open and, you know, the papers blow all over the room or whatever.
I think that could be fun.
And you know what I really as I'm thinking about it, what I really like about what these rules are giving us a hint of how to handle different situations in the game
mm-hmm.
is this sounds like a really great mechanic for group activities, you know, where it's not really about one guy's skill or another guy's skill,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is kind of maybe difficult to do in 3rd edition, where if you have every player make a diplomacy, you know, or a what is it, charm
think,
skill check.
Yeah. I think
and it's like, well, okay, this character failed, but this character got 3 successes. This character got, you know, 3 boons, but he didn't get any successes, you know, and it kind of becomes a bit of a mess, but I could see.
I think that's why they had the whole, I'm assisting you, so I'm adding white dice to
so
your
this,
roll.
So this almost could replace that I'm assisting you thing mm-hmm. and basically be group roles.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
that's great. So, like, when you roll into town and you're like, we're going to all go around and start gathering some information and gathering some gossip, you could probably incorporate that all into one roll now as everybody describes
mm-hmm.
what you give it your base difficulty, and everybody describes how they're going about getting that information. So one guy's going around beating people up, one guy's asking nicely, the other guy's paying people money.
Yeah.
You could use different ways to add dice to that pool and then roll it and give everybody one result. Yeah. That would make that what is otherwise the okay, you roll, now you roll, and now you roll. But you're all doing the same thing, just waiting for somebody to get a success.
And you could even have each individual PC, as they do something, to give them a dice, hold on to those dice, and then roll them. So when you're telling the story, you could be like, well, this is what you found out, and this is what you found out, and this is what you found out. But just do one roll, you know?
Yeah, I think we'll have to explore that concept more. That one's sounding more and more interesting.
Yeah, it's intriguing for sure.
All right, well, when we come back from a break, we're going to hop into what to do with our long-lived PCs. And we're back. So we've got this problem that a lot of people are experiencing, and some of which in our groups and some in others, which is very appropriate now with Heroes Call, that we are going to have a lot of these high-level characters who have been around potentially for ages. Some people think that's great. Some people really have a hard time with that. And what I'm talking about is things like motivation, long-term wounds, what to do with your character, how to keep it challenging. So, you know, this new supplement, Heroes Call, arguably provides a lot of the foundation to keep it fun. But, you know, let's kind of break it down by some of its pieces and really see what some of the inherent problems are and how to maybe resolve some. So I wrote down a couple questions here to kind of give us some structure. But how do you keep high-level games challenging?
The way I would... this is hard because I haven't actually had a consistent group within third edition where we've gotten to high level. I mean, I don't even think we've gotten anybody past rank 2 yet. So this is something I'd be interested in hearing what Jordan has to say,
I'm in a similar boat as you, Lester, where most of my games have all the characters tend to peter out, or we complete our adventures somewhere in the middle of rank 2. So I have never really had the problem or benefits of having a character who's been around for so long that a lot of these things become problems or benefits. I still haven't decided, really.
Especially like a high-level noble character. Like, what happens if a noble, you know, one of your characters becomes the lord of a town? You know, that seems like it'd be really difficult to keep the whole party motivated there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that... there comes a point when players have to assess their characters. When their characters reach a certain point, they have to look at them and say, you know, is it really reasonable for me to continue, you know, for this character to continue adventuring, quote unquote, you know, does it make sense for him to be slumming around with a troll slayer and a rat catcher in the sewers under Nuln, you know, if my character's like this, you know, if he's a baron or something like that, would he be caught dead doing something like that? I think, you know, there's so much variety to campaigns too, though, that you could just as easily have, you know, a troll slayer who feels out of place because the game is starting to go off more into dealing with the noble houses and stuff like that, and he really, you know, there's nobody for him to, you know, bring his mighty axe down upon. So personally, now, it hasn't happened to me for Warhammer specifically. I haven't had any characters get really, you know, high level in Warhammer games, just because the tendency of Warhammer not to last that long.
Lose an eye or something like that.
Yeah, well, you know. But I haven't, you know, had it with other role-playing games. And I think the key to keeping games challenging isn't so much about, you know, to any degree, the numbers. It's not like, okay, well, I just need to throw bigger and tougher enemies at them. But really, I think you need to up the involvement of the PCs in the sorts of plots that they get involved in. So rather than them having to deal with bandits on a back road, then you have them have to deal with a thieves guild who is, you know, they're kind of like, there's this extortion racket going on, and they can't just go in and beat the thieves, you know, over the head and win the day, because at the end of the day, the thieves guild will live on and other people will take their place. So they have to deal with the thieves guild in a more, you know, more from a legal approach. So they have to approach the city watch, and they have to kind of get involved, and they have to get involved with the local noble houses to kind of get them to flush out the bad, you know, influences.
Do you think, do you think that the scope of the games changes as you play longer? And what I mean by that is, you know, it sounds like Heroes Call is taking on a more heroic approach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, I read that as you're fighting bigger bad guys. You're the effects of what you do are wider spread, mm-hmm. and wider felt.
Mm-hmm.
So is it something where, you know, as a new character, your adventure probably takes place in one building or one sewer in one mm-hmm. small village.
Yeah.
But as you become a more prominent character in the realm, or your character is capable of handling more, your scope broadens. You all of a sudden are taking on regions, you're taking yeah. on towns, you're taking on nobles, you're taking mm-hmm. on major creatures and characters. So does at that point that you're taking on these larger scale problems, do you stop role-playing the minutia and you begin taking on, instead of like, I'm paying my 5 brass for the night at the inn, is it just like, yeah, we're just going to bypass that now because we're dealing with, you know, days on end as opposed to minutes on, it's very difficult to play a nationwide game.
Yeah.
When you're still right. dealing with brass.
I think the best thing would be in that circumstance would be to handle it with just like an upkeep, like handle monetary things with a once per game upkeep. They pay so much and that takes care of them for food and right. lodging for the whole time. Like for your example, if you were playing a really high level envoy and you were traveling between Altdorf and Middenheim and Nome and all these places trying to, you know, gather troops to go defend against, you know, an invasion from Kislev or something like that.
Right. So, I mean, like, do you role play every single day on that journey, which might take you a year? Or do you break it down in like almost, you know, fast track where each session is maybe just you visiting that region and you kind of get away from the details.
And like, it would be kind of like a movie where you're only going to address or role play the very important
montage.
Yeah, exactly. You're only gonna address the like really important portions of the story, you know, like the epic action sequences or the really important role playing sequences.
Yeah. You get into what a lot of different gaming styles then at this point, because some people I know love doing high detail every single day, and that's part of the role playing experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, for me, I like role playing it out almost like it is a TV show or a movie where things get fast paced and time flies at certain parts and go slow at others. I think that's an interesting concept that we should probably dive back into.
I think
in the future on scope.
I think it's so difficult too, because like you said, their groups are so different, so varied, like vastly varied, that some are going to want to have social challenges. Some of them are going to want to have combat challenges. And I think keeping the game challenging at high levels in a combat sense isn't going to be that difficult. But I think doing it in a social aspect would be pretty difficult, at least from my perspective as a game master.
So speaking or dovetailing off of keeping the game challenging, how do we keep players motivated you know, during the long haul? I mean, you know, arguably people have some plot seeds when they build their character that will keep them motivated throughout the first several adventures. Mm-hmm. But at some point, those old problems will likely be resolved. And if you've got a talented GM, he's likely seeded some new plot threads to carry you forward. But, you know, what do you do when your character's motivation is starting to wane? Yeah, what are some good examples there? Do we have any like real world examples?
You kill them off, obviously.
Well, yeah, I was just gonna say
it's my dirty little secret.
If my motivation's waning on my character, I'm just gonna retire them and start a new character.
So let's table the retiring concept for a second, because I want to get back. I do want to revisit that.
Yeah.
Because we've got a character. They've got motivation problems. Maybe you're just bored with them. Maybe they're the first character you made, because you were learning the game and they're the most advanced character you have, and you have a hard time just saying, I've invested this time in it and I need to set them aside. You know, I know, Layla, you have some experience with that right now.
Yeah, I hit that point with Helga, I don't know, like a couple of months ago, I think, even. And she's obviously still around, but definitely I was trying to figure out a way, like, to maybe kill her off somehow. And I, so far, haven't had really an opportunity to do so, but I find myself playing with her much more recklessly and allowing her to get into situations where she may or may not be wounded fatally.
I mean, I think she finally got into combat in our Lure the Lich Lord campaign, where she actually got, I think she got hit for the first time.
Yeah, she got bludgeoned, like, by this massive, what were they called?
It's called an Ushabti.
Oh, yeah.
Which,
oh,
wow. For those of you familiar with the Warhammer world, it's like an Egyptian, it's an Egyptian, like, a statue, almost like an Egyptian mummified ogre.
But may or may not have... have consequences in, like, actual real time that
yeah,
we're
you'll have to listen to that game session, which is actually a really fun one. I think you guys will enjoy. It's got some very unique concepts to that.
So how did that not cleave her in twain? Isn't she like
she took 9 wounds from
okay.
I did,
so it,
right.
So it did do a lot of damage.
Oh yeah, it was a heavy weapon that this thing rocked her to the ground, but it oddly enough didn't cause any criticals, but
it
brought her down to being I'm sorry?
Did that motivate her to go hide or
She ran. She did.
Yeah, actually, I wouldn't. Should I talk a little bit about what the concept with that game? Or should we leave that one?
Well,
let's wait till we get more into that.
Let's wait until we reveal what you're doing with
okay,
it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna hold off on the details of that. There's some interesting stuff we're trying out with that game to.
Because this is kind of a side adventure that we went on because Thorin the Dwarf wanted to play a little extra this month, and.
We needed to find some creative ways to take the group that's already in the middle of an adventure and get them on some other random adventure so we could keep playing. So we had some fun exploring ways to do that, which is probably another good topic we should talk about sometime.
How to weave
adventures together or how to unweave and weave at the same time.
Yeah.
That'd be an excellent segment topic for sure. I think as far as the motivation is concerned, though, you could always continually write into your backstory. You could write other things in your backstory. If you're bored with what you wrote initially, you can expand on what happened to your character before what is currently happening to them to get them motivated. Or a good game master will always should have the skills to plant motivation into the story.
Mm-hmm. What do you guys feel about carrots, like magic items or epic monsters and gold to keep people motivated? I mean, to what degree does that motivate you guys?
Personally,
I know you're going to have a different perspective, I think, than Layla will.
Well, I'm really against magic items in the Warhammer world. Maybe
we're talking in the scope of long-lived character. I think at that point, magic item or two, you're a hero at that point. It might even be appropriate to have some.
Yeah, maybe if you're like a Luther Huss type person or you're like an Arc Lector or something like that. Yeah,
I mean, at rank 4 or 5, you effectively are.
Yeah, well, depending on what you're in, if you're a rank 4 or 5 thief, I mean, maybe you've gotten your hands on some minor magic item through thievery, but, I mean, a noble, unless you're, like, one of the elector counts.
I'm not talking about, like, running around with a rune fang.
Yeah, you're
but,
probably
I
not
going to
have...
You know, you're probably going to have...
Like some dice?
Some stuff.
Some magical dice that always land on 7 for you or whatever?
Yeah, like, I typically would say you'd hardly have any magic items, but at rank 4 or 5, I almost expect you to have something.
At least
one,
maybe.
If not even, one or two.
Because
if you're going to go fighting Archaon, you're going to
need
some stuff.
Fair enough, yes.
Yeah. So what do you guys feel about, at high ranks, I think it's appropriate to entice characters with some magic items.
I think a lot of people.
And some that actually do some stuff, not just the little silly ones that roll 7s.
Well, yeah. I mean, in my opinion, my particular perspective, might be slanted just because when it comes to it, the theme of Warhammer is what draws me.
Yeah,
and part of the theme of Warhammer is that even... that you get the impression, at least, maybe not so much from the battle game, right? Because the army books in the battle game have hordes and hordes of magic items. But, unlike in, applicable example, Dungeons & Dragons in its later editions, where it kind of explicitly tells you the formula for, well, this is how magic items get created. How long it takes, and this is how much money it costs, and in Warhammer, magic items with some minor exceptions to like dwarf and rune magic, there's not really like any kind of there's no magic item formula. Like there's no way.
I think it isn't. It's my understanding that for the most part, magic items are no longer being created. They just already exist from the olden days, and with some few exceptions where things like are created maybe by imbued with like chaos magic or something. But everything that's already like that. Existing, it just kind of needs to be refound or stolen from somebody who already has it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that the high elves still create magic items, and the dwarves still do as well.
Right.
Yeah, and they said that even those that do create magic items, you know, in the present day in Warhammer, like, you know, we're talking like wizard lords and that sort of thing. If a wizard lord or if a dwarf rune lord is going to go through to the effort to create a magic item, he's not going to hand it out to anybody. He's basically going to keep it, you know, he created it because...
Or give it to his lord or something. Yeah, he might give it to his, like, the king or something like that as a like a token of loyalty or whatever.
So I want to revisit this concept, though, where we were talking about killing off characters, retiring characters. How do you... You know, maybe Layla, tell us a little bit about what you were thinking of doing with Helga. Because you were talking about potentially killing her off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have options like retiring a character, the player themselves attempting to kill their character off, or the GM killing a character through combat.
Well, my idea was just to kill her off somehow.
Just jump off a bridge.
I was going to try to do it a little more subtly than that, but then actually Jesse thought to make her an NPC, so maybe don't kill her off, make her like, you know, walk away into the sunset and maybe she'll reappear later as just like an NPC somehow. I thought that was an interesting idea, though. Personally, I kind of just want to put her to rest.
you got to leave it ambiguous. Like,
barrier in the border, princess.
Everybody thinks she's dead. Like, she was killed and then... She disappeared in the fog at the last second, and nobody was sure if she
collapsed. The cavern collapsed on her at the last second, and you don't know if she's alive or not. Yeah, that's pretty sweet.
But I mean, this kind of brings up the concept of: do you guys like the idea of starting fresh every once in a while, or do you like the idea of continually playing with that same character and continually evolving that same one?
I think it all depends on the character and the group that I'm playing that character with. I mean, certain characters I'd really like to revisit. I personally love Lucas Haas, the rat catcher that I was playing with you in the very first sessions that I play with. I would love to revisit him and play him for a long time because I have a long-term goal for him. But for the most part, I do like to start fresh and create new characters and have new experiences and explore the whole world as opposed to, you know, sticking one to one storyline, basically.
So let's touch on the last part here that I want to talk about, which is, let's just say for the sake of argument, your character has just died or you have chosen to retire them or for whatever reason are forcefully or unforcefully done with them.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to re-engage the group, roll up a new character, and keep playing. Because odds are there probably wasn't an entire party wipe, probably just one character died. How do you guys like to handle experience points for replacement characters? Do you start them off back at zero when everybody else might be at like 15 or 20 experience? Do you start them off at 20, right where they left off, or perhaps...
I think I'd start them at the beginning of the rank that the party's at.
Yeah,
like, if they're at 15, I would go give them 10.
There's a lot of formulas that people have kind of come up with on how to handle this, and I was going to throw a couple of them out there as examples to kind of just maybe one will sound cool to you. Starting at the beginning of the rank was certainly one of them, so effectively round it to the nearest 10 going down. The other one was beginning experience at half that of the highest experience in the group. So if somebody has 18, you begin at 9.
Mm-hmm.
Other ones were... the one I found the most interesting, which I'd probably consider using, was one where you start at the current rank minus... or rounded down. So if you're at 15, it'd be 10. And what they allow the player to do is to purchase experience through almost like purchasing a backstory or what's happened to you to bring you up to where you are. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, you know, you can have another experience point if you draw a critical wound. You can have two more experience points if
insanity.
You draw an insanity.
That's great.
And you kind of like, you can see where that's going. You can have four experience points if you draw a mutation.
I'd almost, what about...
And it allows you to force some difficulty on your character to bring them up to, so they're not just like a brand new rock star character, yeah, crystal clear with 18 experience. Instead,
what about making them permanently burn a fortune point in order to gain a rank, or like a level or two, or experience point or two? So the character is slightly less lucky, but you know they can be relatively the same level or whatever.
I think what we can see here is there's a lot of really creative ways to approach getting somebody back in and making it so that they don't, because you don't want to feel that like the character is penalized too heavily for dying.
Sure.
Because especially, you know, some people like to give you half the experience, but you gain double experience until you catch up. There's a lot of different techniques there. There is no right answer, but ultimately you want to feel like the player is back up where they were, but maybe with a little bit of a penalty for getting killed. Because sometimes it's not the player's fault that they died. Yeah. Maybe they were supposed to die.
And maybe they were doing it heroically too. Yeah, maybe they were defending the whole party.
Right, so you don't, like, for the Slayer, for example, if he kills himself the way that he wants to die, that's him playing his character properly. And you can hardly penalize him for doing so. You should almost give him a benefit for doing that.
Yeah.
So you really want to take it case by case and decide what's appropriate.
Yeah. I think I'd also give them more benefits if they write a really good backstory for their character. If they really get into the detail, I would probably give them a lot. I'd give them the benefit of the doubt and give them extra experience points for that.
Okay. Cool. I was going to say there was a role-playing game. I'm not going to name its name because it'd be like saying, you know, Nurgle's name or something like that in vain. But there was a role-playing game where you actually had a karma trait, and your karma was either good, neutral, or bad. And if you died, if your character died with good karma, in other words, if you did really heroic things, you know, before your character passed on, you got, you know, the equivalent of bonus experience. But if you died with bad karma, then you came back with like negative experience.
Well, we're going to hop into some Q&A here. We're running a little bit of a long show tonight, so we're going to do a just a couple questions. So when we get back, your guys' questions and answers. All right, we're back. As always, you can submit your questions and comments to recklessdice@gmail.com, on Facebook under Reckless Dice, or hit us up on Twitter at Reckless Dice. Marcus Weckman, also known as the Wilder Mess, emails us in, "Hey, Reckless Dice crew. I have a question concerning the Chaos Gods. Are the common folk of the Empire actually aware of them, or are all the bad things that happen attributed to some less defined dark force or general witchcraftery?"
The latter.
That's a technical term. The reason I ask is that I stumbled on a passage in the Winds of Magic in the Advanced Magic and Wizardry section that goes like this. "No doubt you would have heard rumors of the terrible foe that preys upon our order. Wild fancies spoken in ignorance by apprentices, half-truths surmised and guessed at by your own fellow acolytes, and whispers overheard among your elders. And no doubt you will be expecting that entity to be named herein. And so this name I give to you here, it is known by some as Tzeentch, the inscrutable changer of ways. This seems to imply that only after completing his apprenticeship as a budding wizard was the narrator taught about the existence of a Chaos God.
Narrator,
to me, this means that there's... Well, this is this was an excerpt from the book where it was a excerpt from a tome or some writings of someone.
Yeah.
So this is a quote from a quote from a book.
Well,
from a quote.
I would say that you're
from a book.
So let me finish. There's one last sentence here. But to me, this means that there's a snowflake's chance in hell that some mud-stained peasant in Stirland is aware of the true nature of the Chaos Pantheon. So what are our thoughts on this, and how should it be interpreted when introducing the Chaos Gods to our players? Mm-hmm. Thanks for your time in the podcast. Cheers, Wilder Mess.
Well, there's hundreds of different names that the powers are known by, and like it implies there only a very select few initiated individuals are aware of the true nature of chaos. So I would play it up like he said, dark forces or general witchcraftery.
Yeah.
I think effectively the more educated you are, the more you may know.
But the more educated in the arcane you are, the more you know. I don't think that some scholar necessarily, unless he stumbled across an arcane tome, would really be aware of who Tzeentch or Nurgle is. More so, you know, how economics work or whatever they've gone into the scholastic disciplines for.
Yeah. Certainly, well, somebody who's privileged to read, you know, which,
yeah,
though it's become the reading literacy becoming more common in Warhammer in the present day, but the average you know, citizen not being capable of reading and writing, anybody who could read, I could see, would have a little bit more potential to stumble across some of those names.
So my impression, that the use of the symbols is probably more yeah, appropriate, the visuals. Yeah. So that's why every chaos cult has an icon, and that icon is inherently disturbing and representative of something dark. And that people may be more familiar with the name of a chaos god as a holistic entity of bad than they would be of the differences between Khorne, Nurgle, Zinch, or Slaanesh.
Yeah.
So they may have heard the terms before, maybe familiar with the terms, but they wouldn't probably be able to tell you much about them aside from chaos equals bad.
So let's assume that an educated character is making a check as a game master to know about, you know, a chaos god.
Okay, you've just uncovered a cultist who has some strange tattoo, and you want to understand what that is.
So what difficulty would you make that test for an educated? Well, it wouldn't even have to be educated.
Let's try our live role playing. Okay, Lester, who is your character? Lester, you being the dwarf, have just come across, or no, you being the educated scribe in Altdorf, have just come across a body in an alley.
Okay,
that body has a peculiar tattoo on its shoulder.
All right, I scratch my chin and look at this. And rack my mind. I look at this tattoo and rack my mind to see if I've ever seen this anywhere before. Because, I mean, am I aware of the fact that this is a cultist, or is this just a body?
And so you go ahead and make me an intelligence roll.
Well, why am I in the alley in the first place?
I don't want to get into that much detail.
Oh, okay. Improv.
An endless description here.
Okay.
Who am I?
I'll make.
What's my motivation?
That might be like, okay, well, let's do a two. I'm going to do probably a three difficulty at the least for anything chaos related, because that is something most people wouldn't know.
I would even go higher than four to recognize the symbol of chaos as a scribe.
Well, three or four. I mean, in theory, four is considered a near impossible task from a mechanics perspective.
Yeah,
three is a very hard task. I think most people are going to find it hard pressed to succeed on a three. And even then, if you succeed, I would maybe let you know, hey, okay, this is a, you recognize this as a symbol of one of the dark powers, and then depending on your levels of success, I might tell you specifically which one.
The
more success you get, the more specific I'll get, because that might be the best way to kind of handle that.
Yeah, that works good. And give corruption, I think, if they get a chaos star.
You know, that's actually not a bad idea. Okay, that's a cool one, though. I think we should really consider that. Chaos is known, but the specifics are the ones that are hard to find.
Yeah,
I think the average mud-soaked peasant in the Empire would just considers chaos to be one thing. Like they say, "Oh, we, you know, fear chaos; it will consume us all." But they don't really understand, you know, the depth of it.
You know, it might be a little different for some of the races further north who are regularly attacked by chaos marauders.
Yeah, you might give a bonus to someone from Kislev or Ostermark or something like that. They might get a bonus. That's fair enough.
Sure. So our next question comes from SuperMayu80, and he asks on via Twitter, how do you guys as GMs handle players who create a PC with less than ideal attributes because of the flavor of their character?
Attributes, hey? So I'm the one who says things weird.
Attributes.
Also known as attributes.
Attributes? I'm just kidding. You guys are ribbing me. I felt
you see, you put the wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable.
The epitome of hyperbole.
So how do I handle players like that as a GM?
Well, basically how do you?
Well, let's.
You hit it right there. You don't handle them. It's kudos. I mean,
yeah, if that's what they want to do, role playing, right?
Yeah.
And I guess let's clarify what we mean by less than ideal attributes,
like
too.
A two on strength.
Okay.
Like a
when I first read this question, I thought that the person was talking about like a nasty character, like somebody who just doesn't want to cooperate, who's just kind of like a horrible person.
Oh, when I hear attributes, I'm assuming.
But I think you guys are right.
I'm assuming.
Oh, you mean like an uncooperative player?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But like on purpose, you know, to like sort of be.
That's a good question too, though.
Yeah, but.
Yeah.
Well, that was like our other episode where how do you deal with like crappy players?
I guess so, yeah.
I think, but this question is I'm fairly certain that he's talking about statistics-wise, or basically the opposite of min-maxing your character.
Yeah, like my character is extremely antisocial or nervous. He feels nervous in a social situation, and he's also as ugly as the mud. So I give him the lowest you can give him is a 2 for fellowship. So
what about something that goes into this question would be. Somebody who makes a character who is not combat oriented.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or somebody who's exclusively combat oriented. That would be somebody who is, you know, not a well-rounded character, which is kind of the same. What do you do when you have a character who's not well-rounded?
I think you give them opportunities to use what they're strong at. And I mean, it depends on what they want to play. If they want to play a character who fails a lot, and because that's what they want to play, you know, you can never tell. Some people want to win all the time, and other people want to create a good story, you know.
Well, failing is winning.
Let me throw it out there. Actually, you're exactly right. When in role-playing games, think back to some of your most memorable moments that you've ever had in a game. I'm willing to bet that most of those things have revolved around failing in some capacity or another. They're the most memorable parts.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was playing a game when we first started playing with Neil through the Fantasy Grounds. I was playing a game with Paul and Neil, and my character failed with the Chaos Star, and I fell down a ladder, and, you know, and my crossbow went off because I rolled Chaos Stars and I dropped my weapons and, you know, I basically fell right into the lap of a bunch of cultists who were in the process of summoning a demon. And that was way more memorable to me than when I actually managed to defeat my opponents, you know, through martial prowess.
Yeah, I mean, like when Conrad Weissman was going through the sewers chasing a cultist, he went reckless and he was running through the water and decided to run instead of go cautiously and ended up tripping and falling into the water with all sorts of Chaos Stars, gulping down sewage and ultimately taking on some diseases at the end of the adventure. And it just made for this like beautifully horrific scene that I don't think I'll ever forget from role-playing.
Yeah. It always pops into my head, too. That's exactly what I was thinking of as well.
Yeah. So ultimately what we're getting at here is if somebody wants to have a less than desirable statistic on their character or some kind of built-in detriment on purpose,
go for it.
Full-on thumbs up. It's the best decision they could make.
Yeah, I like
that's absolutely thumb. Warhammer.
Double high five. You know, heel click those people. I like people who do that, who play for the story and not for the mechanics.
And those kinds of situations usually earn extra fortune points from me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Me too.
So I think this will be our last question for tonight since we're running a bit late. Tim, who will no longer be called Tim Rub or Rube, he has corrected our spelling and pronunciation. It is Tim Roos. I hope I got that right.
That's just crazy town.
It is. It is. That thing has got to be a capital B. But you know what? I trust him that he knows what his language is, how it's working. I just don't even know how to make that
character. Is Crazy Town a small village in California? Or?
Also known as Banana Land. So he posts on the Reckless Dice wall, in all the live sessions, I noticed that the party sheet doesn't get any attention, or it's hard to see it get used at all. Same goes for my own sessions. I remember after getting 3rd edition, I was intrigued and thought it was a really cool idea, and he still thinks so. So, what do we think about that, but what could be done to use it more effectively?
Oh, I love this one. I like using, like, let's say the party's going on a large adventure, and they're gathering supplies. I like to track the supplies on the party sheet.
Oh, interesting.
You can use all sorts of different things for the party sheet. You can have them change the party sheet depending on kind of how they're going about it, you know. Or, like, I don't give my party initially when they start, I don't give them the opportunity to gather a party sheet. They actually have to role play for a bit. And then I give them access to a couple of them that they can choose from that suit the way that they've been playing as a group.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't let them use, like, keen eyes. If they have a what is that, a focus talent? If they have a focus slot on their party sheet, I don't let them use keen eyes there so that everybody can use it. It has to, you know, I kind of limit it a little bit, but there's all sorts of different things you can do. I like it mainly, though, for tracking the supplies, or I have, like, an idea for it's basically called travel fatigue, and as they travel for extended periods of time, fatigue actually builds up on the party sheet, and everybody in the party is considered to have that as a base level of fatigue consistently until they have an extended period of rest.
Mm. Yeah, I do. I definitely do the prolonged fatigue for weather conditions or kind of like persistent effects.
Yeah.
It's funny, you use the party sheet for all the things that I don't use it for. The only thing I consistently use the party sheet for is to monitor group stress.
And I really like that. I love the party stress meter. It's my favorite thing ever.
Yeah, I think it's really good.
And as a disclosure, I more often than not don't even track anything aside from just mention periodically when something happens. Yeah. Oh, guys, okay, party stress has gone up. And at some point I may, if it happens enough, I'll throw out a stress to everybody. But I think that is one of the more comical elements that you can include, but also has some tangible effects.
And then, yeah, if the party starts to play as though they are stressed out, especially if they're stressing each other out, if they start role-playing,
exactly.
I'll give them
fortune dice. It reminds everybody that you're, like, you're freaking each other out, and either keep it up because it's hysterical, or, calm down because you guys are all in trouble.
And if you keep it up because it's hysterical and you role-play well, I give you fortune dice on the actions that you're making and stuff like that.
Well, cool. I think what we'll do is save the rest of the questions for next time, since we've gone a pretty hefty overboard on our 1 hour mark this episode. So that'll wrap it up for this episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Be sure to comment on the site, recklessdice.com, or shoot us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com. If you guys enjoy the podcast, please show your appreciation and support by giving us a review on iTunes. It's greatly appreciated. Till next time, thanks for listening. As Lester would say, record.
Nope, it's record.
Are you sure?
In Alberta, yeah. It might be different in Toronto or Vancouver, but in Alberta, it's record.
Is it rubber band or rubber band?
Neither. There's no such thing as rubber bands in Canada.
What? What do you call them?
You guys have funny gun laws too, don't you?
They don't exist. We use string and and snowshoe. What do you call that? The shit in the middle of the snowshoe.
Are you joshing?
This malarkey and bamboozling.
What is Josh? What is joshing? Is he a friend of yours?
I'm gonna keep this up for the entire podcast because I think we'll confuse the heck out of people.
I'm going to totally play it up.
Welcome to the 27th episode of Reckless Dice Teaches You World Culture.
How to be a correct human being.
Yeah, we're not going to teach you what's right. We're just going to teach you how to convince people you're correct.
That's all that matters, really. As long as somebody else buys it.
I was going to say, that's what rhetoric's all about, right? You don't actually have to be right. You just have to prove the other person's wrong.
Hey, that was 3 years of law school for me.
All right, I think we're going to take these little, like, intro segments and put them at the end of every episode, because the last time that was fantastic.
What, the thing
about... Are we recording right now?
Yeah, we're recording.
The thing about Sweden was pretty genius.
We got some good comments about that.
That entire segment was wrong. Like, I'm pretty sure all of us said something incorrect about geography at some point.
Except for Jordan, I think he stayed mostly silent on that.
Well, yeah, but you can't default to silence.
No, you're just automatically wrong.
Yeah.
If you don't correct us, you're also wrong.
That's correct.
I don't know. I prefer to watch people make fools of themselves. So you know.
Welcome to the show.
You've come to the right place.
Ding 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 ding.
All right, let's get this thing rolling.